And this is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. We start the Friday news review with a check-in on Columbus and the state legislature. Joining us live is Ohio Public Radio's State House News Bureau Chief, Karen Kassler. Karen, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Hey, great to talk to you.
Karen, usually when we have you on, you might be joined by one of your colleagues, Joe Ingles or Andy Chow, and we run through a whole list of legislation that's being discussed and other issues across the state, but you've been pretty busy with one item for much of the week in recent days, and that is Ed Choice. So why don't we just start with what happened with the latest?
Well, the best part of the story is it's not over yet.
Yeah, it's going to be.
So we've been dealing with this all week. But what happens here is we're talking about a state-run private school voucher program, EdChoice. It's based on what grades your individual school building gets. If your school building is considered failing, then you can apply for a voucher to send your kid to a private school. And the EdChoice voucher program has dramatically increased the number of buildings that are considered failing because of some changes in the way that testing is done. We changed our statewide testing policies and the actual test itself. We also changed the statewide school report cards, went through to an A through F grade card system. All these changes, for a while, school buildings were kind of held harmless, and those changes didn't apply. Now they're all applying, and so the number of schools that are now eligible, considered failing, has grown dramatically.
Well, let's talk about that term building, because we're not exactly talking about the infrastructure of the school. That term is used to talk about classroom results.
Right. And when we say that, for instance, if the EdChoice voucher program goes forward as it's supposed to, according to state law, tomorrow, and the EdChoice voucher application window opens, 70% of Ohio school districts will have a building, at least one, that qualifies for EdChoice. So it's not based on districts, it's based on buildings, individual buildings. And the thing is, with 70% of Ohio school districts having a building that qualifies for EdChoice, that means even some of the best school districts in the state have buildings that qualify for EdChoice that are considered failing by one of six criteria. Those criteria are things like graduation rates, performance index of student individual performance ratings, K-3 literacy. That's a big one that a lot of lawmakers have looked at and said that they don't feel that it's appropriate to judge schools based on that. And so the situation is, though, that while lawmakers have tried to come up with some ideas to make some changes before that window opens tomorrow, right now that window is set to open tomorrow with no changes.
So it's just a program that takes public dollars and assists students in their tuition fees at private institutions?
Yeah, and this one is unique in that this will take money for those vouchers for students, $4,650 for kindergarten through eighth grade, $6,000 for high school students. That money, then, if you get an EdChoice voucher because your building was considered failing and you use that to go to a private school, that money comes out of your public school district budget. It's not paid for by the state. It's paid for by the individual school districts. That's been a problem for people who are advocates for the public school system, for a lot of Democrats who are very concerned about the effect of that money leaving the public school system. $261 million over the last 2 years has gone to EdChoice from public school budgets. And so that's a big part of this, because with the changes that have happened that really hit tomorrow, if no changes are made, we go from 517 buildings that qualified for EdChoice during this school year to next school year, 1,227 buildings will qualify. So more than doubling the number of potential EdChoice students out there, and that potentially could double the amount of money that could be coming out of public school districts' budgets.
So why are there so many more buildings possibly eligible for the EdChoice program this year when compared to last year?
Again, it's all those changes that are hitting all at once. The law changed back in 2013 to create these criteria that would determine whether a building was EdChoice eligible, whether it's considered failing or not. But schools were kind of held in safe harbor, so to speak, because of the changes in testing and report cards and that sort of thing. But now everything is all phased in. All these criteria are phased in. And so now that criteria is really hitting schools, because if you fail in at least one of these areas, one of these six criteria, your school building is considered failing. And for a lot of these elementary school level, the K-3 literacy rate is a big one, because that's considered to be a measure that's really hard to really get a grip on for a lot of schools. And that's the one that I think a lot of lawmakers, including House Speaker Larry Householder, have some real concerns about.
I believe that we were told that there may be instances where some schools might have, let's just say for easy math, 90 out of 100 score appropriately on any given measure, but then the following year have 91 out of 100 score in the appropriate area, but that only shows like an increase of one student, mm-hmm. whatever that percentage yeah. is. Are they being penalized for that?
Well, yeah, because the whole idea is continuous development, continuous improvement. And if you have a certain number of kids who aren't achieving that, while the rest of your school is doing fine in this one area, they may not be so doing so well, that can send your building into a failing category, which is one of the areas, you know, like K through three literacy is that's kind of the area that they're talking about here. For instance, the Senate passed a proposal that would change the number of EdChoice qualified school buildings starting tomorrow from 517 this year down to 420. And the House came back and said, well, hey, if we take K through three literacy rate out of the criteria, then we're down to 188 buildings that are considered failing. So a dramatic decrease in the number of buildings considered failing just by taking out that one criteria. But again, none of these changes have gone into place. And so if things still remain as they are tomorrow, when the application window opens for EdChoice, there are going to be 1,227 buildings that will be considered failing where students can qualify and apply for EdChoice vouchers.
What do we know about the geography of these 1,227 buildings? Are they pretty well spread out across the state, or are they centered in urban districts?
They're all over the state. It's 70% of the state school districts. So it's really, and again, some of those are some of the best school districts in the state. And that's been the frustrating thing for a lot of advocates for school choice who've been saying, hey, this is not what we intended vouchers to be used for. We intended for vouchers to be used for people who are in failing school districts and have they want to move their kids out of them. And you know, it's not intended to be something that everybody could access, though there are certainly people who would like to see school choice be accessible to anyone. And so there's been kind of a whole discussion about what school choice means and what the idea of a state-sponsored private school voucher actually means. And I think that's been a lot of the discussion that's been happening all over this issue, even as we wait for some sort of resolution to come out.
What are we hearing from school districts? Are they concerned about their financial well-being?
Absolutely. I mean, school districts are very, very concerned. And the proposal that came out of the Senate on Tuesday, it lowered the number of school buildings that would qualify for EdChoice, but it also increased the number of income-based private school vouchers. That's a separate program the state runs. The state pays for those income-based vouchers. The school districts pay for the EdChoice vouchers because they're based on a school's performance. And so this proposal from the Senate had some school districts concerned. But then Speaker Larry Householder came out with a proposal that said, hey, I want to scrap all these performance-based vouchers and turn the whole thing over into an income-based voucher program that the state would entirely pay for. School districts like that a lot because the money then wouldn't be coming out of their budgets. It would be coming from the state. So they've been very, very concerned about this the whole time because potentially, the window opens tomorrow and 1,227 buildings qualify. That's money that comes out of their budgets.
So that did that amendment not go anywhere?
Well, right now, we have an amendment from the Senate that lowered the number of EdChoice buildings and increased the number of income-based vouchers. Then late last night, I might add, the House decided to try to extend the deadline. The application window opens tomorrow. The House tried to extend that to April 1st to give everybody a little bit more time to figure all this out. Well, now that proposal has been turned over to the Senate. The Senate's supposed to have session here in about 45 minutes, but there's no clue as to what the Senate might do. Senate President Larry Obhoff has indicated that he doesn't like the idea of putting this extension in place, and he says it's time to solve the immediate problems before us. He put out a statement last night saying we shouldn't be asking Ohio's school children and educators to wait for months. So he's saying let's go back to the proposal that the Senate passed earlier this week and get it done now, as opposed to putting on an extension and making everybody wait for another 2 months.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking now live with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Karen, what is the motivation politically for the proponents of expanding the EdChoice program?
Well, I think there's a lot of support for school choice in this legislature. I mean, the legislature is dominated by Republicans. The Republicans dominate 2-1 in the Senate. They are in the majority in the House. There's been a lot of support for school choice and voucher programs. The state runs 5 of them. And I mean, it started with the Cleveland voucher program back in the 90s under former Governor George Voinovich. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the state won the opportunity to have a program that allows for the state to offer private school vouchers. Those vouchers can be used at secular schools or at religious schools. And the idea was to build on that a little bit. But now you've got these different programs. And there are voucher programs for there's one for autism, so that if you have a child with autism and you want to send that child to a school that specializes in autism and children with autism, then you can do that. And then, of course, there's the EdChoice program we're talking about and the income-based vouchers. A lot of different things going on here. But the EdChoice program has been the one that I think has gotten the most attention because, again, the window opens tomorrow. There are about 29,600 kids who are on private school EdChoice vouchers right now and about 13,000 kids who are on income-based vouchers. So you can see that it's not a huge number, but it's certainly a significant number. And it's money that, once again, comes out of public school districts' budgets. And here's another thing I should say about that. Not every school district gets the same amount of money per student. And so some school districts get less per student than a voucher would be. So some school districts will only get $1,000 per student. But if they have to pay for a $6,000 high school voucher for that student, then that means they're having to chip in $5,000 extra because they only get $1,000 from the state. So it's potentially budgetarily complex.
Wow, that is a significant amount of money if a certain number of students are able to leave the public school system and have that money follow them to the private schools. That's got to be a concern for the public districts. So I'm wondering then, you mentioned that they can be secular or they can be religious. I guess this also includes charter school opportunities?
No, charter schools are actually public schools. So charter schools do not accept vouchers. And that's a common misperception about charter schools. But so I can completely understand why people feel that way. But yeah, these are vouchers that are only able to be used at private schools. And for instance, I'm here in Franklin County in Columbus. There are 57 schools that accept vouchers. Overwhelmingly, they are religious-based schools. I mean, when I look at the list, it's like 49, I think, out of the 57 are schools that have some sort of religious affiliation to them. But that's completely allowed. And it's certainly, from talking to some of the kids and parents in the EdChoice program, it's something that a lot of these families really want. They like the idea of being able to send their child to a school that has a faith-based direction. Now, that's the kind of thing that really irritates people who don't want their money spent this way, because they say, why should I be paying for someone else's child to be taught a faith that I may not agree with? But that's the way that the program runs.
Well, that I bring up charter schools because I'm curious about the different types of schools that are available. This also, I guess, doesn't necessarily allow you to move into a different public district despite where you might live?
No, you can't just move into another public school district. That's true. If you live in one district, and it really comes down to what building is your child supposed to be going to if indeed you would send your child to whatever school building in your school district. That's the building that's considered failing under the EdChoice plan, and then you would use that EdChoice voucher to go to a private school. But you know, there's a whole list on the Ohio Department of Education's website in the EdChoice section listing all of the schools that accept EdChoice vouchers and also all the schools that are considered EdChoice eligible. Now, whether that list changes or not really depends on the Senate today. If it feels like there are only two possible scenarios here. Either the Senate can not do anything, and therefore the window opens tomorrow and 1,227 buildings are now EdChoice eligible, or the Senate agrees with the House and goes ahead and does an extension so that the application window opens on April 1st. And that gives lawmakers another 2 months to try to figure out what they want to do. What's interesting here, though, that in that 2 month period, we have a little thing called the presidential primary. So yeah. I don't know how that's going to potentially keep people distracted and maybe not have them here discussing these issues. It does feel like it comes down to the last minute quite often here. I mean, last year we had 4 budgets, this 2-year state budget, the transportation budget, and 2 other budgets. three of the four budgets were not signed on time. So this is the kind of thing that it feels like it happens a lot. And here we are in the same position again, where we're just hours away from the application window opening and nothing is resolved.
Well, what are the proponents of expanding the access to private schools? Do they cite any data that suggests that these types of moves for students in failing schools or schools that are perceived to be failing based on the state data, is there any evidence that this is better for them educationally?
Everybody's got their data. You know, everybody's got studies. I know that it's been talked about a lot that the Fordham Institute, which is a really pro-charter school and pro-school choice organization, has even put out a report that says that kids in these voucher programs don't do any better in other schools than they would have done in their public schools. But there's a lot of different things that come into this, and everybody's got their statistics, everybody's got their reports and that sort of thing. But quite often, the people who want to see the voucher program remain or want to see it expand talk about things like, I want to do something different for my child. I went to a Catholic school, say, and I want to send my child to a Catholic school. And so that's the kind of arguments that you'll hear, people saying, I want to make these choices for my child, and I don't want my child to be in the public schools. But the public schools will look back at things like the Ohio Constitution, which says that the state is required to fund a system of common schools that everybody can attend and everybody can access. And that's the state's obligation. The state has no obligation to support any sort of private school voucher system. It's a longstanding argument between people who support vouchers and people who don't, and the idea of where that state money should go. Should that state money go to public schools that everybody can access, that there's a vested interest in making them the best as possible? Or should people have the choice and the opportunity to go somewhere else if the private school's not, the public school's not meeting their needs?
On the other hand, there must be some parents out there who have been able to take advantage of the voucher system to place their kids in a private school of their choice, who may now be concerned about losing access to that.
Right. I mean, if you've got an EdChoice voucher, you're going to be able to keep the EdChoice voucher going forward. If you'll be in the program. The question is, for a lot of these folks, is if your school is on the list of 1,227 that will be EdChoice eligible tomorrow, unless something changes, unless the Senate does something, the people who are on that list, whose school didn't qualify last year but does qualify this next coming school year, those are the people who are saying, hey, we're very concerned. We want to access this voucher program, and potentially lawmakers could cut us off from that. And you know, I've been hearing on my Twitter feed, there's been a lot of discussion, and it's really been interesting to hear people express themselves from both sides of this issue, talking about how personal this is to them. People who say that, you know, I've gone through the private school application process, I've you know, set aside some money for the applications, I've done all this, and now I'm in limbo here. But then again, the school districts are saying, hey, we're in limbo too, because this could potentially cost us millions of dollars, and we need to have some sort of resolution here.
Karen, I know you got to run another busy day ahead, but before we let you go, can you just let us know what Governor Mike DeWine has had to say about all this?
Well, he was concerned primarily, he wouldn't get into the whole issue in general when my colleague Joe Ingles talked to him yesterday. The one thing he did mention was that he was concerned about an amendment to the Senate-passed bill that I talked about earlier that would remove the state oversight. The Academic Distress Commission is what it's called, the state oversight over the Lorain City Schools. There are three districts that are in state oversight in Academic Distress Commissions, East Cleveland, Youngstown, and Lorain. This would remove Lorain from that, and he said that he thought that was a bad idea. But other than that, he really didn't have anything else to say about this, and I think he's trying to look at this and saying, what do I need to think about, how am I going to get into this, because he could be dealing with this sometime late tonight, as a matter of fact, if the Senate passes something.
Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, we appreciate your time and all the great work that you and your team do out of that bureau, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot.
We head to Frankfort next for a look at some legislation coming out of Kentucky, and later the WVXU News team joins us in the studio for a look at this week's local headlines. The Friday News Review continues. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now as we head south to Frankfort for the latest from the Kentucky General Assembly. Joining us on the phone, our Louisville Courier-Journal reporter, Joe Sonka. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael.
And Lexington Herald Leader reporter, Daniel DeRochers. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how are you?
I really wanted to open this particular segment with an REM song, but I wasn't sure if I could get permission to do that. And we're going to be talking about Michael Stipe a little bit later on because of a little Twitter feud you two had. But first, let's discuss some serious matters. I'm curious, just from both of you, before we dive into some of the legislation that's being discussed in the General Assembly currently, what is it like now that a Democrat is the governor? It's Andy Beshear, and he's dealing with this Republican-controlled legislature. Joe, starting with you, how are things just in general so far?
Well, it didn't really get started off on a good foot. Republican leadership was upset that they heard about the budget as Beshear was giving his budget address Tuesday. They're upset that they weren't briefed beforehand like the media was, even though Democratic legislators also weren't briefed. But ultimately, the Governor Beshear has laid out his budget, and it funds a lot of the priorities he wants, and it doesn't fund some of the others that he wish he had if he had more tax revenue. But ultimately, this is going to be in the hands of the legislature, and which has a Republican supermajority in each chamber. So the end result of what we're actually going to see in this budget is probably going to be a lot different than what Governor Beshear proposed on Tuesday.
And Daniel, from your perspective, what are you sensing just from the relations that are developing from the executive office and the legislature?
Yeah, I think you're always going to have a conflict. I mean, you've got a Democrat in the executive and Republicans in the legislative branch. I think that they're is certainly more of an effort to kind of, I guess, change the tone, to have this cooperative working relationship between the governor's office and the legislature. But, in these situations, a lot of the power really lies in the hand of the legislature. So they can, yes, foster a working relationship. But Andy Beshear can talk about how much he wants casino gaming all he wants. And if the votes aren't there in the legislature, it's not going to happen. So really, it's kind of, he can use his bully pulpit to try and influence them, to try and encourage them to approach and pass certain legislation like he has with the sports betting bill. But until they get the votes, until they actually take action, we're not really going to know, or they're the ones who kind of hold the power in that situation. And especially with the budget, they're the ones who write the budget, and they're going to preserve their ability to override any veto. So they're going to be the ones who ultimately decide what goes into this thing.
And I am noticing that so far, a lot of the legislation that is moving around in the legislature, whether emerging from committee or passing one of the two chambers, they are traditional Republican oriented policies, sanctuary cities, photo IDs to vote, moving Kentuckians off public aid into the workforce. But we do have sports betting, and we want to talk about that, too. But first, Andy Beshear did present that budget. Joe, what were the highlights of that? What's significant about the budget that he proposed when compared to, say, the previous governor?
Well, Beshear campaigned for, I guess, almost 2 years on giving teachers, each teacher, a $2,000 raise, which he fulfills in his budget. He also at least claimed that he fully funded public pension payments and also the expansion of Medicaid. The latter, that the first point I mentioned on fully funding public pensions, is actually open for debate because the state retirement plan claimed yesterday that it's actually about $80 million short. So that's going to be an issue going forward. But partly to pay for those initiatives, Beshear's proposed 4 tax increases. One assumes that the sports betting bill is going to pass, which would bring in new revenue. Also a 10-cent increase on cigarettes, a new tax on vaping products, and also increasing the minimum tax on limited liability entities by $50. So altogether, that brings about $150 million more dollars of tax revenue. But there are a lot of things that Bashir wanted to get done that he couldn't because of the basic lack of new revenue created. And obviously, as Daniel mentioned, his big item that he campaigned on was legalizing casinos, which he said would bring in $500 million a year. And obviously, that's not having that is going to be a huge blow to his wish list. But Republican senators have pretty much said there's no way we're going to legalize casinos. So you might as well move on to other things.
And Daniel, the General Assembly has been in session for the better part of this month. But now, I guess, after the budget address by the governor, is this really when things start moving in terms of activity there?
Yeah, things will start picking up. It'll get a little bit more exciting. There's the higher profile bills are going to start to move a little bit more quickly. A lot of this is deadlines, right? So, there had always been this argument that no legislation really passes until after the filing deadline because representatives and senators are worried about being primaried. They moved the filing deadline up, and still really not much legislation has moved. And so I think that what it really comes down to is, you've got this 60-day session where they're talking about bills, where they're trying to whip votes, where they're trying to move a lot of legislation. And the biggest, incentive to pass things is that, hey, we're going to run out of time. And so as time ticks on, we start to see more and more of a flurry of bills. And so we're starting to see some of the priority legislation move. Today, House Speaker David Osborne said that public assistance reform bill, which would go out of its way to try and the state would basically pick up the tab for people who are basically below 200% of if they're above 200% of the federal poverty line, then it'll pick up their health insurance and pay for the employee's health insurance. That's going to get a hearing in 2 weeks. And so, sports betting is still on the docket. It might get a hearing soon where it's really going to, we're going to start to see some of these more important measures move as the time ticks on and they approach that deadline of, hey, we're going to run out of time to pass all the things we need to pass.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Joining us on the phone now are Lexington Herald leader reporter Daniel DeRochers and Louisville Courier Journal reporter Joe Sonka. Let's talk about sports betting. This is a bill that is sponsored by an Erlanger Republican from here in Northern Kentucky, Adam Koenig. He's been pushing this since I think the federal government allowed this to be an option. It is legal in some states now. Joe, can you just give us an explainer on what it means?
Yeah, so basically this would allow Kentuckians to go to licensed facilities, which in Kentucky are pretty much horse racing tracks, and people could bet on sports there, and there's a framework set up to regulate and tax it. Their estimate is this would bring in about $22.5 million per year in new tax revenue. This has a lot of support in the House. I think it would probably get over 60 votes at least in the House if it actually came up to a vote. It passed out of committee very early in the session, but it's kind of been sitting there in the House for a few weeks now. And the big question on that bill is whether it's going to pass the Senate. That is a much less hospitable environment for the legislation. And the word is that the House is trying to get as many votes as possible to give it a favorable expression so that the Senate is moved to also vote on it. And there's also a new 501c3 that's putting up ads in Kentucky with famous sports figures calling for legalized sports betting. It's a really popular measure, I think, or throughout the state. It's just a question of whether it's going to get through both branches the session. And obviously Bashir has assumed that it passes in his budget. So we'll see if that starts moving.
Well, Joe, why does there seem to be hostility in the Senate, which is also Republican dominated, and there's a supermajority of Republicans in the House that seems to support it? What's the disconnect there between those two chambers?
Well, the Senate is there's a little more it's a little more conservative in terms of gambling. They're the chamber that says absolutely no to casino gaming, and there are the same type of arguments against sports betting as there are casino gaming. President Stivers in the Senate has also expressed a little skepticism about why these should be only at horse racing tracks, why they shouldn't be other places. So I think that's one of the big questions right now in the Senate that they're going to have to get through.
And Daniel, go ahead.
I think Stivers really kind of stands in the way of this thing. He's the one who's the Senate president. He's got a lot of power there. Damon Thayer, who's the Senate majority floor leader, he supports casino gaming. But Stivers is, you know, he's definitely kind of standing in the way of this thing. And I think that you also have to look at the bodies themselves. For whatever reason, it's kind of shaken out where the House has been almost the more deliberative, pragmatic body, where the Senate has been more throwing this red meat, throwing, you know, if you look at their priority legislation, the Senate came out instantly with stuff that was, you know, big on for the conservative base. It was the, you know, the illegal immigration bill, the voter ID bill. It was these kind of stuff that kind of fire up Republican voters, whereas the House has, you know, they're the ones who are in charge of producing the budget first, and then they're trying to, you know, with their priority legislation, do bills that have a little bit more bipartisan support. I know the public assistance reform is one where when Democrats hear it, they instantly cringe, but it's actually the approach that they've tried to take is one that has been based with Democratic input. So it's kind of interesting to see that dynamic shake out. And I think that one of the big examples of where we're seeing that is in sports betting, where the House is more willing to approach this, to pass it, and the Senate is more reluctant to, because they're kind of more guided by those conservative values than the House is right now.
So, Daniel, are there any proposals from Republicans to increase revenue? Is there any concern that the state needs more revenue?
There's absolutely a concern that the state needs more revenue. It's just a matter of how they do it. So it's still kind of early in the session for revenue measures. We're not seeing too many out there. Sports betting, of course, is one that is proposed by a Republican. What we've seen in the past is we start to see these revenue measures when they're negotiating on the budget. They think about them. They say, okay, well, what do we need to pay for what we have in the budget? And then they look at the different bills that have passed to see, how can we add up enough revenue to help pay for these things? We did see the Republicans in 2018 pass kind of this, you know, it was the most comprehensive version of tax reform that we had seen in a while, where they brought down the income tax for the most wealthy and corporations and made it a flat 5% tax and increased the sales tax. And that tends to be where they move along those lines. The other place where they've had success in the past is increasing the cigarette tax, and that's been proposed by Representative Jerry Miller, who's a Republican out of Louisville. He's got another bill that would raise it that 10 cents, and that's something that Beshear talked about in the budget. And we might see that. The problem with those types of cigarette taxes is that the reason that you raise the cigarette tax is it kind of in a way to disincentivize people from smoking in the first place. And so if that tax works correctly, it'll make less money over time because there will be less people smoking cigarettes.
And they did just raise that tax not too long ago, didn't they? Like 50 cents.
Yeah, we're still, yes, we raised it by 50 cents. We're at $1.10 per pack, but we're still a little bit lower than West Virginia. And if we raised it 10 cents, we would still be lower than, I think, Ohio and Indiana. Don't quote me on that.
No, that's true. We live right on the border up here, so we see a lot of Ohio plates in Covington buying their cartons.
Exactly. And that's something that Robert Stivers actually bragged about, was that, you know, even though Kentucky raised the cigarette tax in 2018, we're still lower than the states that surround us. So that still kind of, I guess, gives us a competitive advantage there.
Joe, let's talk about the voter ID. Senate Republicans have passed a bill requiring Kentuckians to show a photo ID to vote. This has always been a little confusing to me because I'm a Kenton County voter. When I show up to vote, they've always asked for my ID. What's different here?
Yes. So 98% of people. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Joe, go right ahead. That's all right, Daniel.
Yeah. So you do have to show an ID right now, but in Kentucky, but it does not have to have your photograph on it.
Ah, okay.
So this bill would say that it has to have your photograph on it, and if you don't have a driver's license, there's a means for you to go to your circuit clerk's office and get a free ID. Now, the proponents have called this a solution in search of a problem because the Secretary of State and the bill sponsor who support this bill can't point to a single instance of in-person voter fraud where someone's impersonating another person. So they're saying, well, if this doesn't exist, why are we, you know, putting up this new legislation, this new law that might create obstacles to someone trying to vote. So that's the big debate right now on whether this is really necessary or not. And Republicans saying it's a preventative measure. In case there ever was voter fraud, it would be caught.
But they didn't have a lot of examples of actual cases?
They had zero examples, in fact. Damon Thayer, Senator Damon Thayer, who we referenced earlier, he was on the Senate floor saying, oh, voter fraud happens all the time, but it's just hard to catch, and prosecutors choose not to go after it. He didn't give any examples. And we haven't heard any specific examples from the supporters of the bill of it actually happening.
And Daniel, what can you tell us about House Bill 1, which I guess indicates that that's a top priority of a legislative body? It's I guess it would move some Kentuckians off of public aid and into the workforce.
Well, so they look at it as public assistance reform. The House had presented this. It was a way more drastic version of public assistance reform. I think it was 2 years ago. And basically, like, advocates were like, whoa, you can't do this. This is going to kick a bunch of people off of public assistance. And so they had this public assistance task force that met in the interim, where people came in and they gave them recommendations. And so mostly this bill is kind of conforming to those recommendations. The big thing in this bill is that a common problem for people who are on public assistance, they find out that if you take a slight raise at your job, all of a sudden you're going to get kicked off of Medicare. And so you're going to end up losing money because you got a raise at work or because you took a job. And so it in a way, it almost disincentivizes people to take that raise, to move up the ladder in some of these settings. So they're trying to fix that by saying, okay, well, we're going to cover your medical expenses for longer. So now if you are below, so if you make 130% of the federal poverty line, right, you will still be able to get the state to pay for your insurance in your job. If you make between 138% and 200%, the state will pay for your insurance at your job for a year. And then once you're above 200%, the federal poverty line, then you have to pay for it yourself. So just for a salary standpoint, 200% of the federal poverty line is basically around $51,000 a year for a family of four. So the state will be picking up the cost for a lot of those people. And the idea behind that is to say, okay, this will enable people to take that raise to move up the ladder and to get them off of Medicaid and onto private insurance.
All right, less important matters. I couldn't help but notice this tweet exchange between you two on Thursday. Daniel, is it true you did not know who the lead singer of REM was? Michael Stipe?
Yes, why would I know that?
I guess I forget that you're much younger. And Joe, you were kind enough to drag him on Twitter for that.
A little bit. I mean, he barely even knew who REM was.
So oh, my gosh.
It was really embarrassing.
Well, I see there's a proposal out there to get you guys hosting a Millennial versus Gen X podcast, and I would certainly tune into that. You're always a pleasure to join us, and I would listen to your own show for sure. All right, so Courier Journal reporter Joe Sanka and Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRochers, thanks so much for filling us in on what's going on in Frankfurt. We appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now with my friends from right here at WVXU, reporters Ambriel Crutchfield. Welcome, Ambriel.
Hello.
Anne Thompson. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Michael.
And we also have Tana Weingartner. Hi, Tana.
Hi.
Let's start with you, Tana, okay, because you covered this situation at Miami University. I know that everyone is aware of this coronavirus situation.
Correct.
That's going all over the world and in some respect has a lot of people concerned, but there are a couple of students at Miami who are being monitored?
Correct. So two students had gone to China over the winter break, the J term, I think they call it at Miami, and came back, and one of them had traveled to a portion of China that is affected by coronavirus, or was at the time. So was kind of showing some symptoms like fever and whatnot. And they had traveled together. The second person that was hadn't gone to that zone, so it would be like a first person of contact, just to sort of explain that, because people were saying, oh, they were both in an area. That's not how it's been explained to me. So that's the first person of contact is just also being monitored. We're still waiting on their test results. I talked to Ohio Department of Health this morning. They said they're still waiting. As of 2 hours ago, they said they're still waiting. So Just waiting to see.
I was surprised to learn how large the international population is at Miami University.
Yeah, they have a very large international student population. And they did say about 70, as of this was Tuesday's numbers, about 70 are from the areas that are affected. But there's no guarantee that all of them went home. A lot of times international students, I mean, they've come a very far distance. And so often they don't go home to China or wherever for holiday breaks. They maybe stay and travel within the U.S., you know, see part of the country and all that thing. So they were tracking down all of the students just to see if they had gone home, what, you know, how they were feeling.
Has any student been blocked from coming back?
Not that Miami has told us about. Okay. So we're not that we're aware of it.
And is there any timeline on when we might know a little bit more about what the situation is? And then what would happen if it's confirmed?
Sure. So they said end of week, so today or tomorrow, perhaps, to get the test results back. You know, they're doing a lot of testing at CDC right now. It's the only place that can do the testing for coronavirus. And you just treat it like you would really any flu. So, you know, at the time, as far as we know, the students were both feeling fine. They weren't in hospital at all. So you would just, you know, they've gone through and cleaned at Miami and stuff like that. I'm not entirely certain what they might do should this be confirmed, but, you know, the advice to everyone is your risk is low. This isn't something that if they cough, you know, on High Street that you can get it if you're at Millett Hall or something. It doesn't work like that. You need to be in close proximity.
And I think I read that they don't necessarily want you to just come to the health center, right?
And that's not just a Miami thing. This is just sort of general advice across the board. Should you have been in China or been in, you know, near contact or whatever, you should call the health department or wherever it is you're going to go, your doctor's office. Let them know, hey, this is where I've been, you know, and maybe you guys should meet me at the back door, basically, is what they were sort of saying, or a side entrance so you don't come in through the main lobby. And that's advice for all across the country.
Well, we'll continue to follow and have the latest at WVXU.org. Ambriel Crutchfield, you paid a visit to Owen County.
Yes.
And that's because of a partnership involving Northern Kentucky University and that county and the ongoing fight against opioids. What did you learn?
Yeah, so one thing that I learned that really stood out is that Owen County is one of the highest risk rates for drug overdoses. And if you don't know where Owen County is, it's an hour away from Louisville, Lexington, and Cincinnati. So it's in this like triangle area. And if you've been heading down to Louisville, then you've probably passed by it. And so NKU is partnering with different community members in Owen County to fight the opioid epidemic there, and they have quite a few hurdles that they're trying to overcome, like communication and getting out. It is it's a rural community, so everything's very spread apart, and if you don't have transportation to get to these services, it can be very difficult. So,
why was that county targeted for this effort?
So they were targeted specifically because of their high risk rates. If you look at the stats for Kentucky in different parts, it's kind of staying steady, but if you look at Owen County, it's actually growing higher. And so they were very surprised by that. And so the federal funding they received was to combat that there specifically.
I also read in your report that, and listened this morning, that it's a true bedroom community, right? So mm-hmm. like few people who live there work there. They have to basically leave the county to go to work. Was there any discussion on what impact that has on the drug situation in the county?
Yeah, so Shanna Osborne, she's a county native and she also works for NKU. And so she gave me a tour of the town. And so I was just like, hey, like, what are the top employers here? And so she pointed to like the school district and different, like, they're hoping like a hemp farm will be able to provide some jobs. But with disinvestment or like jobs leaving and things of that nature, people kind of went to like a last resort. And then even for people like Darren Carter, he was playing high school football, injured his leg, and was prescribed opioids. And for him, he didn't think that much into it because that was in the 90s. People weren't talking about opioid epidemic. It wasn't a conversation nationally. But he said he took them, and for him, it was kind of off to the races, in his words. He just became addicted, and it wasn't until he went and got incarcerated and, you know, met with his son and really started to reflect that he really decided to get clean.
What did they indicate, NKU and the other organizers in the county, indicate as potential outcomes, positive outcomes from this initiative?
So they're hoping to, of course, decrease the amount of overdose deaths. They're wanting to really build a health culture. And by that, they're meaning like people going to go get regular checkups and preventative measures that people do all the time. But that isn't the way that it's kind of circulating in the Owen County community. So that's two of the biggest things. And they're also wanting to create a recovery community. So people that have had or been addicted to opioids are helping each other. One thing that I thought was really interesting when we discussed like the opioid epidemic and the crack epidemic, it seems like there are a lot of commonalities with as far as being like in desperate measure and wanting to self-medicate. But if we look at how money and how our rhetoric is about the two, it's very different. You know, in the 80s, it was very tough on crime. Even if we look at how much money Congress sent, 1/4 of $1.7 million went to prevention and the rest went to law enforcement. But if we look at the opioid epidemic, 3/4 of the $7.4 billion went to prevention. And so it's very different in how we're talking about the problem and who is impacted.
You can read and listen to Ambriel's full story at WVXU.org. Also with us in the studio now is our midday host and reporter Ann Thompson. Hi, Ann.
Hey, Michael.
You always bring some very interesting and often fun stories
to us. I try to.
And this particular story didn't just air on our little morning edition show. It aired on the big morning edition show on NPR all across the country. And this is about an indoor vertical farm that will become fully automated right here in the Cincinnati area. What does that mean, indoor vertical farm?
Okay. So the concept of an indoor vertical farm has been around for a long time. It gained popularity in Japan and also in Holland, but you add in the aspect of automated, and that's the new part. So right now, there are just a handful of companies, including 80 Acres, which its latest location is in Hamilton. There are some on the East Coast and the West Coast, and 80 Acres says that this building, which is going to be the size of, I think, 1.5 football fields and very tall, where you have plants stacked up on shelves and robots controlling the lighting and the nutrients and the airflow, and this giant robot called Sam, which is one of those big industrial, named after one of their very loyal employees, okay, a woman. And so Sam pulls the plants out like for harvesting and moves the plants around. And so these plants, there are a couple of buildings in Hamilton. One's downtown, but then the ones we're talking about are in an industrial park. And I visited the smaller one, the bigger one, fully automated, is still under construction, but I was able to see how it would work. And they're actually growing greens, leafy greens, culinary herbs, and those are for sale already in stores like Jungle Gyms, Whole Foods, Kroger sells it downtown.
So what's the benefit of having the robots working? Is it a cost thing?
So the cost to automate is actually kind of high. The benefits are to reduce the carbon footprint. Many urban areas don't have land where you can have a farm. And so this would enable those areas to have fresh vegetables. Like, for example, 80 Acres has kind of branched off, and there's another company they formed, Infinite Acres, that is partnered with a British robotics company, Ocado. They do things with Kroger, and also Priva in Holland, a horticultural company, and they're building such an automated plant in Shanghai. So the thinking is, you know, you could have many of these in urban areas, and that would help.
You can read and listen to Ann's story at WVXU.org. We want to talk about another Samantha, another Sam, really yeah, quickly. Samantha, the gorilla, mm-hmm, 50 years old, Tana, the Tanimal Report.
This is the oldest living animal ever born at the Cincinnati Zoo.
Wow.
She's older than her own curators. Like, she's been around longer at the zoo than they have.
Wow, good for her.
Yep.
And we should also note in our
pictures
last...
Pictures of birthday cake online.
Yes, at WVXU.org as well. And should people or should people not look at the Fiona video that's going around right now? She's apparently picked a Super Bowl winner by...
If you can handle hippo vomit, you should watch it. If not, I can tell you which she picked.
Okay. Ann Thompson, Ambriel Crutchfield, and Tana Weingartner. Thanks to all of you for being with us for the Friday News Review. Appreciate it very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Elise Meckler. Our assistant producer is Selena Reader, and the technical director is Josh Elstro. Find archives of our shows online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.